Hello, it's Jake Senziano, host of Jake and Gino Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy since 2016, Gino Barbagin. How's it going?
Jake, I'm doing good, and I'm extra happy this morning. You want to know why I'm extra happy this morning?
Because I saw my chiropractor and had my shake.
Damn, you've read my mind, brother. Had your fruit this morning, so I'm doing wonderful, brother. How you doing?
Always making it happen, big man. We got a multifamily show for you today. Today's guest has over 20 years of experience in multifamily real estate investing. He is the founder and managing member of EM Capital with a background in mechanical engineering from Carnegie Mellon and professional development from MIT. That's a lot, Gino. That's like we're up here and he's a Boston guy. So it's like, you know, I don't know. This is going to go for like he's going to be really smart. So that's all I know. So
we are slackers.
That's right. Chris Lenta, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm great. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you. So Gino wants to get to know you a little bit because I'll just start talking about real estate and things like that. So please, for Gino, share with us your background, what's going on up there in Boston, and how you got into multifamily full time.
Yeah, sure. So like you mentioned, I graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering, came up to Boston. I'm from the Boston area and started a job for a defense contractor. I didn't actually understand it was a defense contractor at the time. I just thought it was a mechanical engineering job, but that's what it ended up being. Did a lot of work for the U.S. Navy doing guidance systems for submarine launch missiles. It was interesting at the beginning.
And, those are like surface to air, so you can take like a plane down from a sub. Is that what we're talking about
here? No, these are submarine launched nukes. So it's a big one.
Take a city out, bro. You don't take a plane out. You take like a
city. No, I didn't know if a plane's going over. I don't know if a sub can take out a plane.
They have tomahawks that can do that.
Yeah.
They usually go
from
to land,
the sub.
But Yeah. They're usually like land focused, but you could do that. That's doable. Yeah.
Sorry, so, carry on about the nukes. And tell me like the difference between like nukes and hydrogen bombs too, because I'd love to learn about that as well.
I'm not on the explosive end of the game.
Damn it.
Right? I get them there. Someone in the Department of Energy figures out how they blow up.
All right. Fair enough.
That's a good question. So, you know, right away in parallel, I moved into an apartment in Boston. We have these three deckers in Boston. So it's tons of these three floor buildings with an apartment at every floor, you know, in every Boston based movie, that's where all the people live.
Yeah.
So I'm living in one of those and I'm looking around like, who owns this thing? Like, how's this, you know, we're paying $2,400 a month between me and my friends. There's three floors. Like, this is a good deal. Like, how do I do this? So I started reading books. It was, you know, pre-podcast era. This was early 2000s. Started reading books and talking to some people and just started looking to buy one. And 2 years later, I bought one.
Who owned it, by the way? Do you remember his name?
Who owned it? Yeah, it was this guy. He was an electrician. He was this little squirrely guy. He was kind of a weird dude, you know? And I'm like, this guy owns this place? And this place is worth like $750,000? Like, you know, and you knock on the door for the rent and he was kind of cagey. I'm like, oh, okay, I can do that.
So Chris, I remember my first guy, his name was Don. He was a sales rep for Marlboro and he was killing it back in Poughkeepsie, Gino. Don was crushing it. He was the man. Go ahead.
But what was running through your mind? You are doing nukes out of subs and you have a squirrely electrician who's making 7 G's a month, probably doing like 2 hours a week. You're like, I'm the guy from MIT and I'm paying this dude and this guy has got this net worth.
It opened his eyes up a little
bit. I thought I was a smart guy. That must have been a gut punch to you, right?
It just made it seem really doable, right? Like, I mean, he was a nice guy, but I was like, this is doable. Like, if this guy figured this out, I can figure this out. So then I bought one 2 years later, saved up some money, borrowed some money from my dad. Yeah, it was quick. I got an FHA loan. Early 2000s.
Were you living in it?
I was living in it. Yep.
No, and you're renting two out.
So it had like an illegal in-law in the basement.
Yeah.
And I lived in that. So I was renting three out.
Nice.
So I was making money day one.
Squirrely. You
know, not just living for free. Yeah. and I actually just sold that deal 2 years ago. So I held it for a while and, so then, you know, that went well. 2 years later, bought another one down the street. You know, things were going great. Work was doing, you know, fine. It was interesting, but it was not like, I wasn't super passionate about it, I guess, in retrospect.
People are going to buy bombs, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these projects are huge, you know, it's a 30 year, you know, research and development to design to transition to production, you know, from go to there's something in the field is like 10 years. So when you're 22, you're like, I don't know, like that's going to happen in seven years. That seems like forever away. Yeah. So yeah, I just kept like slowly growing that portfolio. And then the crash happened, you know, 2008, 2009. And that was around the time I was thinking I really wanted to transition. And everyone I talked to was like, if you have a paycheck, hold on to it, you know? And there was no recession in the defense industry. It was just kind of business as usual. So that put the brakes on for a couple of years. And then I moved to DC to work more directly with the customer, with the Navy. And I saw kind of the whole defense industry, like, you know, how the Congress, you know, allocates defense spending and how it flows down to the different government agencies and how it comes to my company. And I was like, this is a behemoth. Like, there's no, I'm not making a dent in this giant system. And then I have this real estate thing on the side. Right. I have this real estate thing on the side where I have like a lot of control authority. You know, I can make moves, I can refinance. And I really, like, I was like really convinced at that point, probably 10 years ago now, I got to figure out a way to slide over and do this full time.
And how did you slide? I have so many questions before. How did you do it? But honestly, Chris, what was the feeling like when you saw the behemoth and the amount of money and the amount of waste and the amount of disregard for budgets? And what did you feel about that? Because for me hearing it, I feel the pain. I'm like, I can see how great it may be because you're doing something for the country. But at the same time, it's got to be on the other side saying to yourself, this is not what I signed up
for. Yeah, I wouldn't say that it was like the waste that was that annoying or disconcerting. And it's hard to say that there is massive waste, right? Like, it's a very intractable problem. You have, if you think about regular economy, right? It's market driven. There's usually a really consistent demand. So whoever's good at something, you know, drives the price down, and then the competitor comes in and they, if they have an advantage, they drive the price down more. Well, now you think about it, the defense industry. There's only one customer. It's the U.S. government. And no one else does this. Like, no one else makes these complicated navigation systems, and no one else needs them. So it's not like there's a big market.
But those departments also don't want to get their funding cut either. So there's like a conflict of interest there where
certainly.
I think yeah, and so
there certainly
like,
is.
Oh, need more. We need more. Yeah, because they want.
But
to
it's
keep
like it's a good example of where like a capitalist model just doesn't work.
Yeah,
and I don't know what model works, to be honest. And it was tough to figure out. But you know, if you need something extremely complicated with a deep knowledge base every 30 years, you need to fund that in between.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to just go out and find some random engineers every 30 years and be like, hey, can you build this complicated
thing? Your
point
is you got to keep it going to keep it advanced.
You got to keep it going.
Yeah.
So in the middle, there's a lot of, you could call it waste, but at a big picture, I don't know how else you do it. Yeah.
I want to thank you for letting me know that, actually educating me, because I didn't think in those terms. I just thought, hey, a toilet seat costs $1,000. And I was thinking about that kind of waste. I wasn't thinking about the waste that goes into R&D and they're actually funding and they're probably getting a lot of research into other projects as well. And I could see the similarities between real estate and this, because you buy a deal, you don't just forget about the deal. You got to continually fund the deal and put in CapEx and worry about, you know, the future as well. So when you decided to slide on over, what year did you decide to leave and were able to leave the defense industry and go into real estate full time?
So I left in 2018, and I think I made the decision probably in between 2015 and 2016. So it took me, you know, probably 2 to 3 years to sort of, you know, when you make these big life changes, they don't just happen. You don't wake up and say, this is what I'm doing. You kind of, the possibility gets opened up to you and you're like, oh, that's, I never thought of that. And I think, you know, one of the keys for me was just understanding the syndication model. So prior to this, I'd been, you know, raising my own money, putting that in the next deal, getting cash flow, maybe refinancing.
Yeah, so what's the portfolio look like 2015, 2016? What are your holdings?
So it looks like I think I have 12 units in the Boston area. So probably 12 units, 300, maybe like 4 million.
And you're in DC though at the time.
I was in DC, but all my properties are in Boston.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So I moved there like on a temporary assignment for 2.5 years. So I knew it was temporary. All my assets stayed. And actually that really helped with the transition as well, because while I was away, I transitioned from self-management to property management. So that sort of freed me up from that day-to-day.
Third party
property management. Yeah. Right. You know, gave me the confidence that, oh, you can do this remotely, built up that skill set of how do you manage the manager? What tools and systems do you put in place to make sure they're, you know, focusing on the right things, reporting the right metrics. So that was, you know, part of the building process, kind of stepping away, doing more value add stuff, maybe looking for new deals rather than focusing on kind of the day-to-day maintenance requests and leasing issues and things like that. And then, like I said, discovering that syndication model where, you know, other people's capital giving, you know, investors returns, and, you know, you get paid a part of your compensation upfront in an acquisition fee, which allows you to kind of keep the lights on as you acquire and build up that cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Chris, when you told your family, friends, coworkers that you were ditching the job and going into multifamily full time, what was the response?
I think it was mixed. So, you know, my family and friends weren't surprised because I've been talking about this and doing this for 15 years at the time. So they were like, oh, that makes sense. You know, you've been talking about this in a more excited way than you've been talking about your job for a long time. My coworkers were like shocked. You know, they were like floored because they were, you know, I got a lot of like bought from my bosses and stuff like, oh, what sounds like we can't do anything to keep you because you just don't want to do this.
Mm-hmm. You know,
like it's not like I'm going to Raytheon or.
Well, and they don't have the optionality either because they don't have the second, you know, stream of income or the multiple flows. So they're stuck, right? They can go to Raytheon or they can go to, you know, another bond right. maker or whatever, mm-hmm. but that's it for them.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot no other like, option of just opting out, right?
Right. So I think they were just like, didn't really surprise.
Think about how much that floors them. Cause I had a similar experience and I don't think anyone ever was really, you know, entertaining the fact that I could go out on my own and do it because it's basically for them, it started from scratch because they don't right. have, you know, apartments and things like that. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But Chris, yeah. this, I rarely promote Jake and Gene on the education on this show, but I'm going to do it right now because if Chris Lento had learned about syndication years ago, he probably would have left his job a lot sooner.
Yep.
And you don't know what you don't know. And that's the problem. Most people have these limiting beliefs and these assumptions that are completely false. And they're saying, I can't get into multifamily. There's no way. No, you just don't know how to. You've never been taught how to, and you have those limiting beliefs and you're out there listening to the noise when what you should be doing is you should be investing in yourself and seeing how to do it, whether it is a seller financing creative model, whether it is joint venturing with other people, or it is the syndication model. And let's make a combination of all of those. And the only way you do that is if you learn how to do that. And I think once you do that and you have the options, I'm not going to say, Chris, you would have left 10 years ago or 8 years ago, but you would have entertained the notion a lot sooner. You probably would have scaled your portfolio a little bit quicker. You would have gotten deals on what we call the conveyor belt. They would have matriculated. You would have been able to sell them sooner, built more equity. And the rest is history. So for anybody out there looking for mentorship, jakeandgino.com/apply, and you're looking to get into multifamily, don't listen to the noise out there that the interest rates are high and the economy is bad. That has nothing to do with your decision to get into multifamily. It really comes down to what pain you want and if you want autonomy in your life and you want to create multiple streams of revenue. Those are the questions that you need to ask yourself. And if you say yes to those, then go to the website and apply. And Chris, I probably took words out of your mouth, but if you had learned about syndication sooner, would you have left sooner your business? Would you have had the opportunity to leave sooner?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like if I hadn't, you know, I've been doing a lot of podcasts lately and a lot of the questions are like, what would you have done differently if you could do it again? And it would have been to ramp up my portfolio and transition to real estate sooner. Absolutely.
And why didn't you do that? Is it because you just didn't know, you didn't have the confidence, you didn't have the market? What were the reasons that were holding you back?
I mean, I think it was all of the above, right? So I didn't know, and therefore I didn't have the confidence. So, you know, once you understand it and you know what you're capable of, you get confidence to take bigger risks. And then when those, you know, pan out for you, you learn more, you gain more confidence, you commit to something, and then you take more risks. So it's kind of cyclical. And I think a lot of times it does start with knowledge.
I want to fill in the gap here a little bit because, okay, so it was 2015, 2016, you're leaving your job, but you got 12 units. But then all of a sudden, it sounds like we're talking about syndication over here. Mm-hmm. Fill in the gap there of the going from 12 units to advancing your portfolio and leaving your job. I'm just trying to understand that transition period there.
Yeah, so you know, what I was thinking was, well, I had this revelation that I was really just Boston market. And I started probably from a podcast or a book, started to grasp the concept that, you know, different markets have different cap rates effectively. At the time, I was thinking about it as like a rent to price ratio. So like a 300K unit in Boston might be getting $1,800 a month, but I could get a 300K unit, or I could get a unit in Salem, Mass, which is an hour away, for $200,000, and I could get $1,700 a month. So I was sort of like backed into the whole cap rate.
And maybe even a slightly lesser expense ratio there as well when you get to some of these different markets.
Possibly.
Yeah.
So, you know, then I started thinking about markets outside of the Boston area, because we just have it's a low cap rate environment here. A lot of buy and holds long term. So I decided I was going to go to markets that had, you know, effectively higher cash flow. And I learned a lot about that. So I 1031 exchanged a property I had here in Boston, a 5-unit, into a 24 unit in Tallahassee. And I, you know, got a full-time third-party property manager. And this was all just my money. And I was proving out the model to myself. So before I raised capital and you know, went all in on this, I was like, let me figure out if it truly works. So 1031 exchanged it, got probably a 7 cap at the time in Tallahassee, 24 units, 85 build. I still have it. It's a nice property. And it was, you know, I mean, there was hurdles, you know, got agency loan. There was a bit of a struggle there.
Out of the gates you did?
I did, because I had this track record with these other deals. Was able to get a small balance. Was that a Freddie loan? Yeah, out of the gate.
That's when Freddie started coming out. Freddie back in 2015 and 16, that's when they came out with the small balance program. So you must have been like hit the jackpot with that thing.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
I didn't even realize at the time. I mean, you know, I was told I might need a partner on it, and I was like, well, I'll just ram it through without a partner, and if I need one, I'll find one.
Well, it's interesting though, because if you'd done like a community, you know, bank deal or something, you probably would have had, you know, an easier time of getting it done. But you're going for your first larger, you know, multifamily deal, and you're ramming, you know, agency through. That's pretty bold.
And I think to some degree there was like, you know, you have confidence when you don't know what you don't know.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
So I didn't know that was going to be a big hurdle. I was like, why? You know?
Even to this day, you know, like a value add deal, I'll just still do a community bank for the ease of use. And then once we get a clean, you know, income statement and rent roll, then we'll take it out, you know, just for the loan to cost. But that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was beat into me like just avoid recourse at all costs.
Take this. And
and that's where you can get it. You know, it's the only place you can get no recourse, or one of the only places.
So Chris, once you've got the 24 units and it's under your belt and you're doing really well, what does that first syndicated deal look like?
So through various like real estate conferences, I met a number of people, and I decided that, you know,
was
my
it the
value
next deal too? That's what I'd like to know.
The next deal was a 67 unit in Kentucky.
And that was syndicated?
That was syndicated.
Which city in Kentucky, just out of curiosity?
It's in Elizabethtown, which is like about 40 minutes south of Louisville.
Okay.
It's actually pretty close to this big Sky On battery plant that's being built. It's like a $5 billion battery plant. And that came about through a partnership from people I met through multiple real estate conferences. And I sort of positioned myself as I can raise capital and I can get loans.
But you never raised capital before.
No, but that was
you don't know what you don't know, brother.
He's like, I'm here and I do it, folks. Agency, I do it. Raise capital, that's me.
Yep, exactly. So I came in as the capital raiser on a deal that I kind of came in late. People needed capital raised. I had been building up a little network. So I raised, I think, 600K for that deal. And that was interesting because I was...
So you really weren't managing that deal?
Well, my thought was, if I'm going to be in this deal, I want to have some control authority, right? Like, I don't want to be just a capital raiser and
you didn't find the deal. I mean, let's at least...
The deal. Yeah. I did not find the deal. But I kind of said, all right, I do want to play a role in managing, you know, asset managing the deal. And, you know, all that engineering experience was mainly project and program management in the end. You know, I had teams of 60, 80 people working on 5-year projects. So I'm just good at, you know, making a plan, making a budget, following up, kind of team dynamics. And that's what I enjoy as well. And I ended up, you know, not necessarily getting compensated for it, but I'm still running that project. I mean, I would say I'm doing 70% of the asset management on that deal, despite the fact that I'm just the capital raiser. you know, I kind of quickly realized that that's where my skill set is, and maybe that I needed to fill in those gaps with the team.
So from that deal, what's the next deal look like?
So the next deal, I did a couple more 1031 exchanges of my smaller properties to bigger properties, so kind of solo stuff. And then the next big deal, met up with another group of guys at a conference. We really hit it off, and I think we had very complementary skill sets. And I sort of came in as I can asset manage. You know, I've had a portfolio now of maybe 70 units. I can get loans, and I can raise some
70
capital.
70 plus the 67?
Let me think. 67. No, so I had like 100. You know, like I had 110 maybe at this point. And I met a group of guys that it's another company, and they just have a ton of energy, good capital raising, really just good mindset, and very good broker relationships. So we kind of went back and forth quite a bit. They brought deals. We, you know, made some offers. And then we took down a 136 unit in Columbia, South Carolina in 2019. And that was like the first big syndication that I was involved in. You know, I think we raised $5 million. It was a $17 million deal. Exited in 22 for a great return.
That was the year to exit, right?
Yes. We exited. We had some debates, you know, oh, we could get a good return, but the cash flow is great. And now we're like, thank you. Know, we timed it well.
Yeah.
So Chris, what were the thoughts though, selling the smaller deals in Boston? Cause that's gotta be emotional. That's where you started. That's your backyard. That's where you grew up. These are my little babies. They're cash flowing. But if I can sell these and get into 100 unit, why wouldn't I do that? What was the thought process? And really speak to the listener right now, because there may be some people out there that are emotionally tied to their properties and saying, yeah, but I've got no debt and I'm making $1,000 a month on this deal. Why would I sell it? What was your thought process behind
it? So I tried to really focus on return on equity. So yeah, I had $1 million property that's, you know, and the loan on it is $300K. And I'm making 60K in cash a year. What's my return on equity? And it's terrible. So I really try to be disciplined and not get too emotional about the cash flow or that, you know, I lived there for 3 years. And I was just like, I need, in order to grow my wealth and my lifestyle the way I want to, I need at least double digit our return on equity every year, you know, and that's what I try to focus on, you know, 15% ROE all the time and, you know, plus, and, you know, these, if you do the math on that, I mean, I'm not really good at math in my head, but it's probably like 4%, 4 to 6%. And that's not going to get you there. So, you know, I could see the value of selling that or 1031 exchanging it and just ramping up the equity. And maybe the cash flow, you know, day one, as you guys know, wouldn't be as good on that, you know, on that 1031 exchange, but the equity is huge. And I've been able to pull, you know, a good amount of equity out of those deals that I've 1031 exchanged that wouldn't have been there in the smaller deals.
So now you're looking at ROI as a metric.
ROE.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm thinking, yeah, ROE for us is return on effort as well. That's why. But when you're looking at, we like to talk about buy right, manage right, and finance right. That's one of your buy metrics. What else are you looking for when you're buying an asset? What would you call your buy right criteria?
So now I'm looking for a value add proposition, right? Mm-hmm. So I, you know, if you're gonna buy an asset and, you know, you're gonna sell it, or my business plan is to sell it between 3 to 7 years for a good return. And, you know, in order to do that, you're gonna have to raise the NOI. I mean, that's the only way to do it, right? I mean, you're gonna probably assume some cap rate expansion if you're gonna be conservative. So if your cap rate's expanding, the only way you're going to sell it for a profit and have good cash flow is if you're growing that NOI. So fundamentally, how are you doing that? You know, are you hoping market rents go up, or is the market undersupplied and there's great population growth? So you have a good basis for expecting market rates to either go up or stay at a reasonable rate. And then what are you doing to increase those and drive down costs? So I think you need, you know, I wouldn't say a value add story, but, you know, a true components of value add that do then add up to a good value add story that makes sense.
The value add story over the last few years was the government printed a ton of money, We tried to sell it before our expense side went up, but our costs, our income went up. So here's the deal. Government printed a ton of money. We raised the rents as much as we could before the expense side creeped up, and then we hit the exit in 2022. Yep.
And the cap rates compressed.
Yes, that's right. Because the rates were super low and everyone jumped in.
Yep. Yeah.
So now it's back to square one. What do we do now?
Not Chris.
Not as easy, right?
To take that thread, what markets are you investing in right now? What vintage assets are you looking for? Unit mixes? Do you have something really specific? Because when Jake and I talk about buy right, we're very, you know, very focused on within 3 hours of Knoxville. Anything within 200 to 300 units, we like anything of 80s vintage or newer. We like newer assets in this part of the market cycle. Mm-hmm. We love two bedroom townhomes, possibly with garages. We love washer dryer hookups. If they've got brick on the exterior, if they have breezeways, let's get some breezeways covered with vinyl, possibly. If they've got decks, we'd love to have the decks covered. Like, we really try to focus on it. And if an asset comes like that, brokers know that we love that. And if there's something, some differences in it, let's say the decks aren't covered. Well, that's okay. We'll just take that into consideration. And if the asset's older, we just have to say to ourselves, is there price, you know, accordingly, can we actually buy this asset at that price that makes sense? If not, we will pass on that. Do you have anything specific that you're looking for? And what markets are you looking in as well?
So we're looking in the Carolinas, so North and South Carolina, primarily within 40 minutes of the major metro areas. So Raleigh, Charlotte, Columbia, upstate North Carolina, and Charleston. And then also in the greater Atlanta area. So those are kind of the markets. We're looking at 80s or newer vintage. And
are you still aggressive on Atlanta right now? Or
I am, yeah. So there's a lot of supply going in, but it seems like it's topping off this year, I think, is all their big deliveries. And their population growth is still very strong, and there's a lot of jobs moving there. Yeah, I see Atlanta, you know, as almost like the New York of the Southeast. Like, if you look at the whole Southeast, like, what other major metro area is there that's got like an ecosystem around it? And then it also has a lot of manufacturing. Yeah, Miami's a weird place, though, right? I mean, it's far away from
about Atlanta, too.
What's that?
You can say that about less Atlanta,
weird,
too.
Right? It's a less weird place than Miami, certainly.
Well, I'm going to put it this way. I went to a retreat this weekend with my son, and we drove through Atlanta. We had to land in Atlanta. I just don't understand how anybody could possibly live in that city with the traffic the way it is. It's just an absolute nightmare. Now, everything you said, Chris, it's
the
amazing.
The traffic and the service is what drives me nuts about Atlanta. Like, I wouldn't personally not want to live there.
But on the flip side, I can absolutely see why people invest there, because there is population growth. Yeah. There's a ton of jobs, ton of corporations there. The airport is the busiest airport in the world. So if you're doing functions, and I'm talking from I'm just talking from quality of life. I'd rather live in Miami than live in Atlanta as far as quality of life. So as far as investing, I probably would invest in Atlanta before I invested in Miami. But I agree to.
I'm just being a hater because I've had too many awkward customer service issues there as a consumer I hate it. But besides that, I'm sure it's good for investing. So
and then I also like in that 80s and newer, I really like anything with two bed, two baths. So if something comes up with a two bed, one bath or a three bed, one bath, I'm like, that's just, I think it's a good indicator that the construction was low grade at the beginning, you know, when they built it. Mm-hmm. It could be an 89 build, but if it has got a lot of 2-1s, I think that's a sign that it's not a high quality asset. So I like 2-1s, like townhouses, like you said. Let me think, what else? And right now we're looking at sort of tertiary markets around those areas as well. So not necessarily like core Atlanta or core Charlotte, because there's a lot of supply being delivered. But if you look at 30 minutes out, there's a lot of these smaller towns that have very limited supply and they're well located. Maybe you can get to Atlanta relatively easily, but there's also an industrial park the other direction. That's what we're looking at right now, is these sort of,
I like that as
like satellites to a major metro area.
Chris, before we go to the short answers, what would you say to somebody listening to them if they want to get into multifamily? What should they be doing right now to get into the space?
I think they need to be, you know, educating themselves and then finding people to work with and learn from. So, you know, finding mentors, finding potential partners, just effectively networking in the spaces where multifamily investors are networking. So here in Boston, there's a lot of real estate groups, but they tend to be a lot of like condo conversion groups or single family flip groups. And those are great to kind of get some knowledge and maybe some energy about real estate, but you're not necessarily going to meet the people you want to meet in those groups. A lot of hard money lenders, you know, I don't really deal with hard money. So I would say find your groups and network with people to kind of figure out where the good educational sources are and to share ideas.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, guys, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from zero units to over $250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Wield Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from zero to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey in multifamily.
All right, we are back. So you basically, you think you said 12 units in the beginning, and then you went to third party management?
Yes.
Is that correct? Yep. And so did you scale out the management at all? Did you have any team members when you're up to 12, or were you kind of doing like the solopreneur things with it?
Just okay. Solo.
And then when you went to third party, and since you've grown your syndication business, is it still solo, or have you scaled that out at all? The capital?
No. So I have a full-time operations lead, yeah. And then I have a part-time marketing director, and then I have a full-time administrative assistant. So that's the core team.
So you got the team there. So you've scaled that. Now, do you see any opportunity in the future where you would actually do property management in-house, or will that always be third party just because you're in so many markets?
Yeah. So I think I'd have to consolidate markets in order to go in-house. And I've thought back and forth about the value of that. And that's a big difference, right? I mean, a property management company has a lot of employees. It's not really lean and mean, but you can get consistent revenue and you can do other people's properties to get scale. So I would say right now, no, that's not the plan, but I've certainly considered it.
I think the challenge becomes also is retaining quality team members when you're selling every 3 to 7 years too, because that constant turnover makes it challenging to really keep people in place and develop that core group over time as well. That I think also to the model that makes it somewhat challenging. Not that it can't be done, but just maybe a little more challenging than you would
need to.
I think
it's a different business model too, right? I mean, you're talking a lot of a relatively large amount of employees per asset. So like, you know, my model, I've 3.5 people for 600 units. And you go to property management, you have a lot more people. It's a lot more kind of HR payroll intensive.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So I think it's a different mindset.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, you're really operating a team member heavy business at that point. That takes its own skill set, which, you know, you can, you know, develop a syndication company, you know, probably a lot quicker using third party and having a small internal team that you're running and gunning with. So,
right.
Anything that you've read in the last year or so that's added value to your life? Any books or, you know, any maybe like podcasts or anything?
So I do a coaching program called Strategic Coach. It's a Canadian company.
Like Dan Sullivan, right?
Dan Sullivan. So I've been doing that for 3 years, 4 years now. And there's a ton of value that comes out of that. You know, I go up to Toronto every quarter, meet with a lot of entrepreneurs and kind of hash out kind of the common problems that we have. And they have a kind of a coaching program for entrepreneurs. So that's always kind of giving me good ideas and different resources. And I think that, you know, we had a book last year called Who Not How, and it's just about, you know, the first time you have a problem, you got to train yourself to not think, how do I solve this problem? But who is the right person to solve this problem? And if it's you, that's great. If it's in your, you know, your core unique ability, but if it's not, then find the person that loves solving those kind of problems and partner with them, work with them, hire them to help you with that problem. And it's, you know, I think it's a really valuable way to think about things.
Absolutely. How's the deal flow look so far this year? Have you taken anything down yet this year, or do you have anything on the horizon?
No, we actually just lost on Friday in a best in final outside of Charlotte. So, and we were very close. So it was a bit of a letdown. Deal flow
assumption. Was it an assumption or were you putting new debt on it?
It was an assumption with a supplemental. Yeah.
Second place?
Yes. Second place.
Ah, brutal.
I know. Yeah. So it was tough.
Did you go, but it's interesting. Did you go back and diagnose what made you lose the deal? Was it your credibility? Was it the price? Was it, you know, what were the factors that made you not be, I guess, number one?
Yeah. So we're doing a postmortem on it tomorrow with the partners. but effectively, I think we weren't aggressive enough early enough. I think we just had a bad strategy. Or maybe not a bad strategy, but we made some mistakes in our, like, that buying process. You know, there was the first bid, there was, you know, your best and final. And I think we made the assumption that we were close enough that we were going to get into the buyer's interview process. And we still had some kind of powder to juice that up.
But you never got to use it.
But we didn't get to use it. That and sucks. So had we pushed some chips in a little earlier, I think we would have got it. We had the credibility.
Yeah, it's this part of the cycle where everyone's like, they're not being as aggressive, hoping to kind of get the deal. And so that's where it can bite you in the ass, but you might win too, because it is not as aggressive as it was a year or two ago. So it's, right. It's tough. Right. How much did you like off by?
What's that?
I was just saying, how much do you think you lost by? Do you have any idea?
Well, actually, I know that in the end, we sort of gave an unsolicited second, like, you know, we did best and final, and then we're like,
yeah,
why is there crickets for a week?
Yeah.
So we, you know, really sharpened the pencils and said, what's our absolute max? Like, we're going to lose this deal. And we gave another offer. And I think we're either at the offer price or possibly even slightly above.
You just weren't aggressive enough.
They weren't aggressive enough early, and they had already started going down the path with the top team. And, you know, they're saying, well, where do these guys come from? You know, a week ago they gave us something that was 700K lower. And now all of a sudden they're just bumping up their offer. What are they up to? We'll just stick.
And you would have been happy at the 700K higher. Like, you would have been happy with the price. You offered it.
Yeah. It worked. The deal worked. Yeah.
What did you like about the deal?
I liked the location. I liked what value add components were available. So it was an interesting deal. It was, two phases, one like 85 to 90 build, and then one late 90s to early 2000s build. So there were two distinctly different assets kind of pushed together. But they were pretty high quality, and they needed a decent amount of CapEx, and they needed sort of a rebranding and kind of make them a cohesive place that had a feel to it. Mm-hmm. So I think it had a good level of value add needed, and the rents were way below market. So you know, the value add story was there, and then there was zero construction in the pipeline in that market, which was so it had a good moat. It had a good, you know, 3-year.
What did the supplemental look like
as far as the terms?
Yeah.
So it was I think we're going to get a 7.25 rate on it. And it was mirroring the in-place loan, which had 8 years left on it. And I think it went up to like 68% total loan to value, you know, combined.
Which is good.
And was it another syndicator group, or was it more of a, like a mom and pop ownership? What
the ownership? No, it was another syndicator group.
Okay.
And our understanding was that they had some kind of deals in the last couple of years that had not given their investors the returns they wanted.
Yeah.
And this deal they bought right, and it was,
they just didn't get the rents up.
Yeah, but it, like, they could sell it now and make their returns. So they wanted to, gotcha, you know, give their investors a win.
This was, yeah. Even though there was meat on the bone, still interesting.
Right.
Wow. Cool. Interesting stuff. Anything on the horizon? You got anything that you lined up for right now, or just still
a couple deals we're underwriting, but nothing that we're, like, you know, laser focused on.
Yeah.
Hopefully in the next month we'll be in the running again.
Cool. And what's the best way for folks that are listening to get a hold of you?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Chris Lento or EM Capital. And then you can find all my contact information at emcapitalgroup.com, my website.
the EM stands for?
Emerging markets.
Okay. There you go. Gino, what you got to say?
Well, you have a young Chris Lento gets out of college and starts working at a job, and he doesn't know where he's working.
I mean, making bombs. He's working. I wonder if this is like getting flagged for saying bombs. Maybe we'll get like an algorithm for saying it. Or either that or like someone will show up at our door. Anyways, I'm done.
And then you got Jake asking about nuclear subs and Tomahawk missiles, and we're getting off course here. But Chris is working there for a while, and he's renting an apartment in Boston as a triple-decker from this surly, squirrely electrician. And he's like, bro, this guy's making 7 G's a month on this thing. And what the hell am I doing wrong here? And 2 years later, he looks into it, gets the FHA, buys his first deal. And he's like, I'm off to the races. This ain't too bad. I'm going to keep doing this. I like this because I don't like my job that much. I mean, my job is interesting. I like it. But I want to start creating some wealth here. I want to have some stability here. And grows the portfolio to 10 units. And then he finally says to himself, I think I'm leaving. I think I'm going to go out and buy a deal. I found this word syndication. I wish I had known it sooner. I wish I had met Jake and Gino sooner so they could have taught me the word syndication, but I didn't. I start buying a deal. I 1031 my first couple of units in Boston. That must have been really, really difficult to do. But I bought a 24 unit in Tallahassee with problems, third-party property management, because I've got to prove to myself that I can run this deal. And once that happens, hallelujah, man. Then got a 67 unit in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, pulling that bad boy down. I got an agency loan in my first deal. Didn't know what the hell I was doing there. I'm a capital raiser. I don't know what I'm doing, but hey, I can help you guys with the capital. Raise 600 grand, close that deal. Then holy crap, all of a sudden things start trugging along. And I leave my job in 2018, go into this thing full time. Unfortunately, my last name is Lento. And for anybody who's Italian knows what that means. It means a little slow. And it sounds as if Chris was slow on his last syndication. He should have been aggressive as he was on his first syndication and said, you know what? I'm a capital raiser. I can do agency deals. I want this deal. So the big learning lesson in this entire podcast is if you want something, go after it. Have the persistence to go after it. Don't worry about what you don't know. You will figure it out. And if you want something really that bad in this part of the market cycle, you need to make it happen. Don't sit on the sidelines and play second fiddle. If you want that deal in Charlotte, you need to push all your chips in. Make sure that they know that you're serious. Take massive action and go out there and make it happen.
All right. The G-Daddy, everybody. Well said.
It was a great summer.
All right, Tate. Chris, we really appreciate you, man. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy, and we make it happen. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. I appreciate it.